Welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast.
Hello, and welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. This is Eric Loomis, and today I'm very pleased to be with Christina Heatherton, who is an associate professor of American Studies and Human Rights at Trinity College in Connecticut. She's co-editor of Policing the Planet, Why the Policing Crisis Led to Black Lives Matter, and the co-director of the Trinity Social Justice Initiative. But today we are here to talk about her brand new book, just out, I believe, last month, from the University of California Press, Arise, Global Radicalism in the Era of the Mexican Revolution. Christina, thank you for being with us.
Oh, I'm so glad to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah. So would you start by describing your book?
Sure. The book is about internationalism, and I understand internationalism to be a recognition of the ways that people have been unevenly waylaid by the global capitalist system and developed forms of revolutionary solidarity in spite of social and spatial divisions, including national boundaries, to confront it. So I mean, maybe we could just start with the title. The book is called Arise! Exclamation mark, and it, of course, takes its name from the first word of the Internationale, which is the anthem to internationalism. And I kind of see myself in the tradition of other authors who have plumbed the lyrics of the title to try to grapple with the legacy of internationalism at present. So, you know, people like Melvin Dubofsky, who wrote We Shall Be All, right? The study of the anarcho-syndicalist IWW, or Frantz Fanon's Wretched of the Earth, thinks about anti-colonial revolts in Algeria and beyond. You know, one of the characters I talk about in the book is Dorothy Healy, who wanted to title her memoir Traditions, Chains Have Bound Us, which is a slight adaptation from one of the song's lyrics. And she said that revolutionaries have to be able to keep alive the kind of challenging, questioning nature. Otherwise, they're bound by traditions, even those that they call radical. So I think that there's a whole generation of people who have gone back to the song to reckon with the struggles that they found they've inherited at present. You know, and as Fanon said, it's the responsibility of every generation to either fulfill or betray. So, you know, I've been thinking a lot about internationalism. I've done, as you mentioned, a number of other types of scholarly, public, and political forms of education that think about questions of policing and militarism, racism, sexism, you know, struggles that are customarily understood as discrete. And, you know, in all my work, I've tried to imagine how things that are customarily understood as separate can be comprehended together. So, you know, this is a book about how people developed internationalism from below, instead of just thinking about how people have been formally organized into things like an international, first, second, or third international. I'm interested in how people in the era of the Mexican Revolution came to an internationalist consciousness. So, you know, I'm happy to talk about some of the specific characters, but that's a kind of quick and dirty of the overview of the book.
Yeah. And I want to kind of loop back as we go to thinking about this internationalism and particularly in the contemporary context. But I guess to start, you know, if I was, let me put it this way, like, I, you know, if I'm picking up a book on the Mexican Revolution and I don't know anything about, you know, I'm just looking at the title and not really reading the description, I might be expecting a certain number of things. But your book really takes the Mexican Revolution and looks at it in a really different way, over a different time span and a different sort of set of characters and a set of influences. And I'm wondering if you would expand a little bit on the ways in which you see the Mexican Revolution as a critical piece of this internationalist history of the 20th century.
Sure, sure. You know, I think a lot of times when we think about the Mexican Revolution, I mean, particularly in this country, if we don't have a relationship to it, you know, there's a few kind of stock figures that we imagine that are often reproduced in popular culture. You know, Emiliano Zapata, Pancho Villa, the campesinos with, you know, their bullets around them. So let me first just kind of give an overview of what the Mexican Revolution was. The Mexican Revolution is often narrated as a national event that broke out in 1910. As a you know, opposition that coalesced against the president Porfirio Diaz, who ruled over the country in an increasingly dictatorial regimes for over three decades. under in that period of time, which is called the Porfiriato, the country was modernized, the economy was modernized. So that meant a number of things. That meant remote territories were connected to growing urban areas through new rails and roads. New goods were moved through trains, ports, and pipelines. And this period saw this massive incursion of foreign investment in mines, agriculture, oil, and in new housing markets. So these transformations required mass dispossession of the peasantry. It also saw the exploitation of industrial workers. Growing middle class was really frustrated that they felt excluded from their, they had a lack of political representation. There were fractions among the elites and foreign investors who grew wary of the turmoil. So you have all these conditions that really set the stage for revolution that ultimately explodes in 1910. But what I argue, I try to make two kind of complementary arguments to that. The first is that it's really important to understand the revolution as a global story. So the conditions that led to the Mexican Revolution were not unique to Mexico in the period. They just uniquely exploded in revolution, you know, the first major social revolution of the 20th century. So you see many countries that are pulled into the kind of frenzy of finance capital in the late 19th century. You see similar features of mass dispossession, the loss of subsistence agriculture, the unmooring of people from previous modes of production, across a number of Mike Davis's work, he says, you know, the turn of the 20th century didn't unfold as we had predicted, as this era of, urban revolts and struggle by the industrialized proletariat in Western countries. But instead, you have an epoch of peasant wars, anti-colonial struggles, rebellions against dispossession. So we have to understand in the global context. The second argument that I make is that thinking anew about the era of the Mexican Revolution allows us to understand the ascendancy of U.S. hegemony. So just very briefly, it's important to note that by the outbreak of the revolution, over a quarter of all U.S. investment lay in Mexico. U.S. financiers owned over 80% of Mexican mineral rights and like more of Mexico's surface than Mexico's entities. And the first time that the U.S. became a creditor nation was in relationship to Mexico. So as I say, in relation to Mexico, the U.S. developed new forms of indirect rule, new modalities of imperialism. In other words, I argue that in relationship to Mexico, the U.S. developed the capacities with which it would come to superintend the global capitalist economy, which is why it's so significant to think about.
Yeah, so you know, you kind of have these people sort of floating in and out of a story and kind of a long Mexican Revolution. And I guess, one of the first people that you discuss is one of the great internationalists of the early 20th century, W.E.B. Du Bois. So could you talk a little bit about what Du Bois was saying about Mexico and how this helps to frame your work?
Sure. Well, Du Bois, in the early 20th century, Du Bois wrote a very well-known article called The African Roots of War in 1915. And here he's thinking about the consequences of the Berlin Conference. He's really describing a new economic epoch coming into being. What I thought was really remarkable, though, in looking through issues of the crisis is a year before, in a short piece about Mexico, there's a number of the same insights he's making, you know, that he later elaborates in The African Roots of War. So I take Du Bois to be one of my key theorists in this book in two regards. One, I'm really interested in a materialist analysis of the color line. A concept which, I describe Frederick Douglass wrote quite a lot about and Du Bois elaborates. And I make, drawing on Du Bois, I think about the color line not as a physical demarcation, that describes segregation, but actually a way in which racial differences help co-produce capitalist space globally. I'm also interested in what Du Bois is saying in these two pieces of characterizing this period, the era of the new imperialism. So I put Du Bois in dialogue with Giovanni Arrighi, who's thinking about systemic cycles of accumulation, right? So Arrighi's, basically thinking about how the 19th century, especially the end of the 19th century, the beginning of the 20th, is marking the waning of British hegemony and the ascendancy of U.S. hegemony. And Du Bois, in these pieces, as well as in other writings, is really thinking about what new features of the global political economy are coming to the fore in this moment, and how within them the U.S. is developing itself as, a financial superpower in the world. So, you know, it's a kind of unusual way to think about Du Bois, but I feel like instead of, just drawing upon him to think about racism, as I argue in the book, I think some of his insights about the global capitalist economy and the particular form of imperialism coming into being actually, predate, some of his contemporaries and some of the kind of go-to political theorists that we think about characterizing that period.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that one of the points that your book makes that perhaps we don't always pay enough attention to is the, I would argue anyway, that most of these 20th century left-leaning movements are in fact quite international, right? Everybody's reading each other. People know who each other are. People are engaged in a global conversation, whether we're, whether you're talking about the Mexican Revolution or we're talking about, an overly nationalistic view of the American Civil Rights Movement, is just as a different example. And, I think that one of the things that your book really does very effectively is really get at this international, really truly global nature. This brings in a couple of the other, figures that you focus on, such as the Indian activist M.N. Roy or the Okinawan activist Paul Sinche. There's an Asian side of this story too. I mean, it really is a globalized, really is a global story. So, how do these activists in other areas that are dealing with that are fighting colonialism, how do they come to see Mexico as something that matters to them?
Sure. Well, first, I should just say briefly that, drawing from a number of the Mexican revolutionaries themselves, like notably, as you mentioned, Ricardo Flores Magón, who's one of the key organizers, journalists, activists, of the revolution, like drawing from a lot of his works, he's continually making the Mexican Revolution a global struggle. He's both commanding people in Mexico, saying the eyes of the world are upon you. The Mexican Revolution breaks out before the Bolshevik Revolution. And there's a way in which he has a very keen sense that human liberation is tied to the struggle of Mexican workers. And he makes extraordinary, writes these extraordinary op-eds in his newspaper, Regeneración. One of my favorites is the Mexican Manifesto in 1914, where he's like, do you suppose that we in Mexico, over whom the earth's money lords are warring over our waterways, our forests, our oil, do you suppose that we, unless we've read Karl Marx, don't understand, surplus value? Like, we're living this struggle, right? So, I mean, there's a way in which, some of the book is just underscoring the ways in which people within the revolution understood the struggle's internationalism. But as you said, the book also thinks about a whole cast of characters who either find themselves in revolutionary Mexico or find themselves influenced by, by the revolution in some way. And some of these, particularly in chapter two, I'm thinking both about Chinche Paulcochi and also M.N. Roy. I'll just say a few things about M.N. Roy. So M.N. Roy, was a fierce fighter in the Indian struggle against British colonialism. He ends up in revolutionary Mexico in 1917, amidst his global travels to secure arms and money and support for that fight against British colonialism. And while he's in Mexico, somewhat by accident, some of his comrades there, some comradely journalists ask him, they invite him to explain to the Mexican people, in some articles, can you just tell us what this struggle against British colonialism looks like? And he says, in the process of writing, he has this great turn of phrase where he says, I suddenly realized that explaining the struggle of Indian people to Mexico was like carrying coal to Newcastle, right? And he describes in his memoir how it's in Mexico that he begins to triangulate his experience and goes from a hardcore Indian nationalist to an internationalist. And subsequently, he goes on to be one of the co-founders of the Mexican Communist Party. I'll just say one brief coda is that a lot of people in left circles know Roy from his contributions to the national and colonial question, these debates in the Comintern with Lenin. where Roy interjects that there can't be a separate set of rules applied to the colonies if the, you know, struggle for if the global struggle is about empowering the proletariat in Western countries, you can't bend the rules in the colonies and think that you have to make alliances with the petty bourgeoisie in a revolutionary struggle. What's interesting is a lot of those ideas are prefigured in the writings he does in Mexico.
Yeah. And I think it's, you know, it's very interesting to kind of see these figures that, you know, playing an outsized role in the history of the left sort of pop up in the Mexican Revolution in a way that, you know, in a way that you wouldn't necessarily expect. And I think that, you know, that the Roy example is a really important one. Another way, of course, that the Mexican Revolution was somewhat internationalized was that the United States is right there. And both in terms of, you know, helping to create the conditions for the revolution, thanks to the, you know, new imperialism, but also as a place for people to flee to, or at least attempt to flee to, if they are needing to escape Mexico, right? And, you know, Flores Magón, who you have already, you know, first mentioned, is, you know, probably the most famous of those people who come to the United States during the revolution. And of course, he is imprisoned in the United States and dies in an American prison. But, you know, I think that one of the really fascinating chapters of this book, maybe to me, perhaps the most fascinating, is the chapter on the way that the prison becomes a kind of, without romanticizing the horrible conditions of the prison, becomes this kind of like international leftist education space for this really wide variety of people who are in prison for various political crimes. And, you know, I was wondering if you could, you know, sort of talk about that a little bit and put sort of U.S. radicalism in some of the context of the Mexican Revolution, how people like Flores Magón are going to influence the next generation of American radicals.
Sure. Well, I should say at the outset that, you know, this is a book of social history. And in that tradition, every chapter is titled How to Make Something, you know, how to make love, how to make a living, how to make a flag. And the chapter you're talking about is called How to Make a University. And that comes from some Bureau of Investigation files that noted there was this consistent problem of people being arrested, charged with federal crimes and sent to Leavenworth Federal Penitentiary, and then coming out as organizers. So I came to this story to figure out why it was that this great figure of the Mexican Revolution, Ricardo Flores Magón, died in Kansas. And in going through the National Archives and, you know, reading related works, and particularly in engaging in a lot of the literature of the Wobblies, I saw that Leavenworth came up again and again and again, right? People joked about Leavenworth's food. They joked about, you know, how this was like the probable fate for a lot of organizers. And it turned out that, the laws passed with the advent of the U.S.'s entrance into World War I, there were basically laws that criminalized political dissent, made them federal crimes. And so, you know, laws like the Espionage and Sedition Act, criminal syndicalism laws, like meant that you had basically every different stripe of radical in the country, all incarcerated together. Leavenworth, as the oldest and largest of the federal penitentiaries, became something of a crucible for all these, you know, international global radicals. So you had, you had Wobblies, you had pacifists, you had Bulgarian communists, socialists, you had Mexican revolutionaries, you had other people from the Gadar movement also fighting British colonialism. And the extraordinary thing that I found was that they had actually created a university there. So in the process of putting all these organizers together and having them figure out how to confront the conditions of the prison, they also realized that in order to organize together, they had to educate each other. And they produced a university, where there were lectures about theory, there's lectures about revolution, there's lectures about language. So this chapter just tries to really recover, you know, the ferment of that space, like you said, not romanticizing it, but just trying to make sense of what was happening in this penitentiary as a kind of microcosm of how different revolutionary currents of the moment had awareness of each other and were often trying to triangulate their experiences in struggle.
I'm wondering, and this takes us in a slightly different direction, I suppose, but, you know, knowing a lot about the IWW in the U.S. And the ways in which, you know, they are engaging in various educational programming and, you know, even if it's not, maybe program is not the right word, they're just people talking to each other. And I've sort of had the sense, and maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong, but that this period in the teens is really like this very, very fertile period of sort of working class education and sort of working class people taking a, you know, taking the initiative to engage in a variety of ideas that I don't know that you even by the 30s, I'm not sure you see it in quite the same way. Maybe that's because of the, you know, hegemony of the Communist Party by that point, and you have a more perhaps rigid left. But I'm wondering if there's something about this period that makes this internationalism and the kind of ways in which it works out in Leavenworth anyway, particularly fertile.
Well, you know, I would say that for sure. I don't know if there's anything that beats the kind of like wild experimental and kind of joyful spirit of the IWW and how they, you know, like saw education as such a key part of their organizing. And that, you know, education wasn't just formal education. It's like you said, you know, there's like everything from kind of informal lectures to just conversation to music, I think was all part of that. But, you know, in one of my chapters, which actually does go into the 30s, called How to Make a Dress, I do, you know, draw on some studies of different education scholars, as well as people who have studied the, people like Marvin Gettleman's studies of left schools, you know, who talk about the largest system of adult education in the U.S. from the 20s to the 50s, you know, were a series of schools are organized like either or both by labor unions and the Communist Party. And in that chapter, I'm really trying to think about the George Washington Carver School in Harlem, alongside a nexus of, you know, other related schools that come up in the Great Depression, within which there's a scaffolding for a form of adult education. But I think that there's also, it's interjected with a very wild kind of experimental nature. You know, my key concept for this book is convergence spaces. So I'm really interested in these kind of socio-spatial sites where different revolutionary traditions are compressed and produce new articulations of struggle. And looking at these schools, which were, you know, which were organized by the Communist Party, you know, like, I mean, this is a Popular Front moment. And so you see, like, these schools are often named after patriotic heroes. You know, you have the Samuel Adams School in Boston. You have schools named after Thomas Jefferson in New York. But the one in Harlem, the George Washington Carver School, where Elizabeth Catlett and a host of figures who had either been to Mexico or were greatly influenced by the revolution, I think was something really unique. So, you know, not to completely quibble with the contours of your point, but I think that there's different forms of that experimental type of knowledge that are really paired with political organizing that persist, you know, into the Cold War.
Okay. Well, thanks. And you know, one of your chapters that I think it's a good time to transition to, called How to Make Love, focuses on the Soviet feminist and for a brief time ambassador to Mexico, and really ultimately a survivor of more than almost anything else of this period, Alexander Kollontai. And I thought that was a really fascinating chapter. And, you know, feminism is a major part of this book. There's a variety of women that you've used to frame these different chapters. And so can you talk about that chapter a little bit and the ways in which, you know, the ways in which kind of an international feminism sort of runs through Mexico as well?
Sure. Well, for some people, this is a really surprising chapter because, you know, when people think about internationalism related to the Mexican Revolution, there are actually a kind of cast of characters that we imagine. Trotsky in Mexico, Frida Kahlo, Diego, you know, Rivera, even Sergei Eisenstein coming to Mexico, you know, and making films there. And in a sense, you know, this is, you know, the chapter on Kollontai is about the aftermath of all of that, you know. So Kollontai is very briefly the Soviet ambassador to Mexico between the end of 1926 and about July 1927. And I was so interested in this moment for a couple of reasons. One, I think Kollontai, you know, although she's getting a lot more sort of attention now, is a kind of underappreciated figure in the way that she tried to theorize the you know, the gender norms and sexual relations that had to be revolutionized. You know, she thought unless there was serious attention paid to these questions, paid to the social organization in society, you could not truly have a revolution. She was the commissar of social welfare. So one of the first women to hold a major state cabinet position, like in the world. And in this capacity, you know, she had to attend to, you know, a whole range of people in society, orphans, you know, like, I mean, the mass number of children who had become orphaned by the Civil War and the, you know, after the Russian Revolution, you know, people who had been maimed in wars, former soldiers, women who had been divorced, like, and there's a fascinating way that she goes from somebody who's a kind of relative theorist of these questions to somebody who has to think practically about what does it mean to reorganize society so that we don't elevate the primacy of the heteronormative family and think about, you know, everybody just kind of being able to be taken care of, being taken care of as a result. So she comes to Mexico, you know, having, you know, written, I think, beautiful things about how to conceptualize love as a revolutionary principle, as a collective principle. And she has these fantastic engagements with other feminists in Mexico. You know, she's also bringing to bear conversations that she's had with Russian feminists, with German feminists, you know, with people who are trying to make sense of questions of social reproduction, the nature of the family, etc. You know, she also comes up against, like, you know, mighty forces there, you know, not at least, as you said, she's a survivor in the Soviet system. She's coming up against, you know, U.S. imperialism, who are very wary of her spreading Bolshevism around. And she's also coming up against conservative sectors of the Mexican government. So, you know, neither this chapter or any of the chapter paint a rosy picture. You know, my argument isn't that revolution simply happened and, you know, someone just needed to write a book about it. But I was interested in the different dimensions of struggle. And I thought she was a particularly fascinating character to illuminate some of those aspects.
Yeah, and I don't want to keep you too much longer. So let me ask you two more questions here that I think will help sort of bring this full circle. The first is, you know, speaking of the ways in which sort of the long Mexican Revolution has impacts in the United States, you know, you have your chapter on Dorothy Healey and, you know, organizing in California. And, you know, we, of course, often see, you know, California and Mexico as relatively closely connected just because of the border. But, you know, I think that there's a sort of these little known histories of the ways in which it really is a fertile cross-border exchange of ideas and activism that's coming in through much of the 20th century and especially that first half of the 20th century. So could you kind of take that perspective you talked about with Kollontai and apply it in this American context with Dorothy Healey?
Sure. Well, Dorothy Healey has a really fascinating story. You know, in the early years of the Great Depression, she's a very young organizer, and she's organizing in two fronts. One, she's organizing in Los Angeles with the unemployed councils. And I think sometimes we forget that before the New Deal, there were conditions very similar to today. You know, there's mass unemployment, mass hunger, mass suffering, mass evictions, mass dispossession, and not, you know, any relief on the horizon. So the Communist Party model of the unemployed councils, you know, she described this as one of the most transformative experiences of her life, to see, you know, very broken people, you know, often working class women, become organizers, you know, sometimes tenant organizers, sometimes just kind of local organizers in their neighborhood. So she's, you know, a leader in this front, but she gets called into I you know, open the chapter with her organizing with lettuce workers in the Imperial Valley, California, where actually my family is from. And I try to make sense of this as a two fronts of the same struggle. And to make a long story short, you know, sometimes a lot of this book tries to disrupt the imaginary that there are rural struggles, you know, agricultural struggles, peasant struggles, and that there are urban industrial struggles, you know, and when you think about farm workers, you know, sometimes we forget that, well, that work is seasonal. And in the off season, people often migrate to cities. And so, you know, Healy is confronting the fact that these are deeply conjoined struggles, that often the people she's organizing in one place are either the same or related to the people she's organizing in the other place. And often they're being deployed against each other. What I try to elevate in the book is how the experience of the Mexican Revolution becomes so critical to those organizing efforts. There are ways in which people have these memories of the revolution by that point, or their experience. They bring it to, you know, organizing strike camps. They bring it to a kind of confidence within these struggles. She tells this wonderful story about how, you know, she's this young firebrand organizer. She comes down to talk to all these farm workers. She's explaining to them about the class struggle. And she says she's met with this patient indulgence where all these farm workers are crossing their arms, nodding their head patiently. And then when she's done, they go, okay, great. You know, we've just been through a revolution. So, you know, we're ready for the barricades. You just tell us when you're ready. So.
Yeah. No, thank you. And I guess the last question to kind of bring all this around is, you know, what are the lessons, if you're comfortable with this? I mean, what are the lessons for this today? I mean, you know, I feel like we live in a moment that is sort of internationalist, you know, perhaps because of social media and those types of things, you know, but at the same time that there's not necessarily the attention paid or to the kind of, you know, global struggles in the same way as perhaps a century ago, or the intellectual ferment of different ideas all sort of crossing each other maybe isn't as strong. Again, I may be wrong about that, but I guess, and you feel free to correct me, but do you see this story as being something that is, you know, something that activists, leftists, liberals even can pull something from in terms of thinking about the present?
Absolutely. Well, you know, I mean, I feel like this is a history of the present, a history for the present, a history for a different future. So, you know, I mean, this question is definitely on my mind. And I guess I'd answer that in, you know, by saying the first chapter of this book, the introduction, is called How to Make a Rope. And in that chapter, I try to like kind of give a device for understanding the whole book. And I tell the story of the political economy of the turn of the century lynch rope. And I do this because I think there's a fascinating story about how the different strands came from different coexisting regimes of accumulation. So there's Manila from U.S. imperial control of the Philippines. This is the, you know, the fiber that constitutes most of North America. American rope. There are fibers that come from Jim Crow sharecropping regimes. There's also a number of fibers called henequen and sisal, derivatives of the agave plant, that come from the southernmost Mexican state of the Yucatan. And so, you know, there's this extraordinary way that if you understand how these different strands were braided together in the production of this instrument of both commerce and racist tyranny, you can begin to understand how the world was pulled together, you know, under global capital in this moment. But the introduction also unravels this strand and tries to think about the different struggles that are connected through this commodity. You know, and I do this by way of saying there's, you know, a way that radicals in the past and also us in the present can understand how, you know, these forces, well, you know, in the tradition of social history, people think about how capital has always produced its own unintended negations, right? And there are ways in which our fates are tied by the regimes that pull us together. You know, the struggle often is like, you know, as I say in the book, the struggle for internationalism is not as simple as kind of saying workers of the world unite, you know, or must unite, right? I mean, there's an enormous number of fetters, you know, that I talk about in the book that we have to overcome in order to achieve any kind of solidarity. But one thing that I feel like I try to do in this book is really desegregate radical history. You know, these stories are told together because they happen together, because people were talking with each other, because people were trying to make sense of each other's struggles with humility, with creativity, with boldness. You know, I call this the kind of excess that falls out of, you know, rather rigid institutionalized histories of the left. And, you know, I mean, I'll just say from having presented different parts of this, particularly to activist groups of like very young activists, I think the sense that our fates are tied, that our histories are tied, that this is not something that we have to reinvent in the present is an incredibly powerful, galvanizing idea that I feel like, you know, we have to take more seriously.
Yeah, that's a great way to end this. And I want to thank you again for being with us today, Christina. That was really wonderful.
Thanks so much, Eric.
Just to let everybody know again, we've been talking to Christina Heatherton of Trinity College in Connecticut about her brand new book, Arise, Global Radicalism in the Era of the Mexican Revolution, published by the University of California Press. We'll be back soon for another Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast.
Thank you again for listening to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. We would like to thank Elizabeth Nelson of The Paranoid Style for supplying the music necessary to make this podcast possible. You can find this track and the rest of The Paranoid Style's catalog anywhere you can find quality music. If you would like to support the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast or any other aspect of the Lawyers, Guns, and Money project, please visit us at www.patreon.com/lawyersgunsandmoney or donate through the PayPal link on the main website. Thank you again,